During the peak of the coronavirus pandemic panic, all the big stores were open for business, while all of the moms and pops were forced to close. At least, so it seemed. And so we ask, how does big business get to make the rules and regulations?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1233rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Manila who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, it seemed to me like big business had it all figured out. What I saw during the COVID-19 pandemic panic was that big business was open for business, while most every small business was forced to close their doors. I saw this when I went to my favorite garden store at the peak of the panic to buy some plants for the garden, only to find the local store locked up and shut down. I then went to my second favorite local garden store and found it, too, to be locked up and shut down. No problem, I was told. The big box store is open, but you will have to stand in line and wait your turn. When I tell my friends and associates what I believe I have seen, many of them roll their eyes and back away. Fine. But the fact is, big business does have many ways to fight off their small business competitors. To describe some of these ways, the Food Chain Radio is offering up a series of 3 episodes we call Up Against Goliath. In our last episode, we discussed how big business fights with the artful use of the bribe. Today's episode is called The Rules, because one of the most pernicious ways big business fights off little businesses is through the rules and regulations promulgated by bureaucrats. For a perfect example, let's look to the great state of North Dakota, where citizens decided that they wanted the right to buy and sell food from each other. Not a bad idea in the middle of a pandemic, I guess. You sell me a loaf of freshly baked bread, I'll sell you some freshly churned butter, then we'll sit down and break bread together. When the politicians of North Dakota heard their citizens crying out for food freedom, they passed a cottage food bill granting them that freedom. But then, North Dakota's food bureaucracy stepped in and took the food freedom away. And that leads us to ask, how does big business get bureaucracy to make its rules for them? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Erica Smith, who is the senior attorney for the Institute of Justice in Washington, D.C. Erica, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you aboard now. Institute for Justice. Whenever I hear somebody say justice, I always wonder what exactly they mean by justice. So I'll toss that one to you.
Well, by justice, we mean freedom from government abuse. We're a constitutional law firm, and the thing that we do is we sue the government to enforce constitutional liberties. And one of the areas that we do that in is economic liberty, the right for people to be able to earn an honest living without having to worry about red tape.
And that's exactly what we're talking about today. And because, of course, today we're talking about your lawsuit against the state of North Dakota and how you are standing up for the people in North Dakota who want to enjoy some food freedom. Now, Erica, I have a friend out there in Virginia, Joel Salatin, who's been for years Joel's for years has been saying that people should be able to buy and sell food from each other with absolutely no restrictions whatsoever, because you're dealing with people you know, and they're not going to do anything to harm you if it's at all in their possibilities to avoid that. So why should we have government stepping in between two consenting adults who are buying and selling food from each other? It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, first I'll say that Joel is absolutely right, and he does a lot of very good work in this area. And I completely agree that people should be able to buy food from each other. They should be able to buy food from their neighbors and people in their community. I mean, people have been doing that for hundreds and even thousands of years. And it's only recently that the government has been starting to say that people cannot be doing that. And it's not good for people who make this food, and it's not good for consumers who want to be able to enjoy fresh food made without preservatives, made by their neighbors.
And why is it, do you think, a trend exists to resist that urge of people buying food from people?
Well, I think there's two reasons for it. One is that government often thinks that they know best, and they sometimes are looking to fix problems that don't exist, because the more they get to regulate, the more they feel validated and important. So we see that a lot in this area, where you will see a Department of Health coming in and just making all sorts of rules and regulations that are completely unnecessary. The second reason is exactly what you were talking about before, Michael, is big business coming in and not wanting to have to compete, or sometimes even small businesses. All too often we see trade groups like the National Grocers Association or local grocers associations, retailers associations, even bakeries on Main Street not wanting competition. So they try to, and are often successful in, passing laws restricting people from selling homemade food that could compete with them.
Well, here we have a situation in North Dakota that wasn't really the law that was the problem. As I understand it, the legislators in North Dakota heard the desire of the people of North Dakota to be able to buy and sell food from each other, and went and passed a law in 2017. I think it was called the Cottage Food Law. Is that correct?
That's right. Here we had a situation where politicians were doing the right thing. They passed this excellent law. It's one of the best homemade food laws in the whole country. And it allows, or it was intended to allow, people to sell virtually any homemade food. So not just shelf-stable food, which is what you see in a lot of states, but meals, even chicken products. And for 3 years, that's exactly what North Dakotans did, and they loved it. People were selling these foods out of their home, farmers markets, and it was really a great thing.
And then they passed a law. It's okay. They called it a cottage food law. What do they mean by cottage?
Cottage refers to the home. So cottage foods are any type of food that's made at home, whether you're talking about a cookie or jam or, you know, homemade casseroles.
So real food from real people, real simple as that.
Exactly.
And with respect to North Dakota, which is a very rural state, it does have a couple of nice metropolitan areas in it and whatnot, but by and large, it's a very rural state. People still live pretty close to the land. And, you know, boy, when I was raised in Montana, that's what people did. You know, we bought and sold food from each other. And so the trend away from that is really taking place kind of as we become more urbanized, right? Then we lose that ability to feed each other.
That's right. I think over the last 30 years that we've seen these laws go into effect that are restricting people from selling homemade foods. Although I have to say in the last 5 and even 10 years, that trend is starting to reverse and go into the other direction, but it's slow. 49 states allow the sale of homemade foods, but almost all of them only allow the sale of shelf-stable foods, like very simple snacks and desserts. And it's only a handful of states that are starting to do what North Dakota and Wyoming and Utah and Maine and even California are doing, which is to allow the sale of homemade meals. And there's really such a big demand for that because a lot of people don't have the time to cook for themselves and their families, or maybe they don't enjoy cooking, maybe they're not good at it, and they want to be able to go to their neighbors to buy their foods. This is also a really important way for farmers to support their families. And a lot of people who operate under these laws are farmers.
And it's an interesting side note in listening to there, I got to thinking of how significant that activity becomes in the binding of a culture together, of binding people together. If one person has a very busy job and can't cook, but his neighbor doesn't and can cook, it's quite a relationship that develops between those two people. You know, they're taking care of each other.
No, I completely agree. And it just makes sense.
And yet there is a trend against that. And if you are a big, giant corporation and your margin is extremely thin, as it tends to be in big, giant corporations, where they only make a penny out of a dollar's worth of sales or something like that, and you find that people are actually trending toward taking care of themselves again, that's a danger, a clear and present danger, is it not?
Well, that's how they see it. I mean, we argue that competition makes everybody better and that there are different types of demands and different types of supplies to meet that demand. And, you know, sometimes a soccer mom who's making cupcakes on the weekend or at night is going to compete with the local bakery, but sometimes she's not. Sometimes she's just selling to a different type of person. And we should just, the more choices that we have, the better.
In other words, the more competition we have, the better. Unless you're the one on top who doesn't want anybody else to compete with them. And that's the situation we kind of face, I think, in North Dakota and elsewhere, where people are starting to stand up and ask for the right to buy and sell food from each other. I guess that's a situation that's evident pretty much in the Amish communities. And I do believe there are some Amish communities in North Dakota and in the heartland there. But they certainly are the kind of people who believe in buying and selling food from each other and do a lot of that. So these kinds of rules, and I guess the law is good, the rules and regulations are not so good. And that's the problem we're going to address today, because we're really talking about bureaucracies and how the rules and regulations of bureaucracies can be so detrimental to the entrepreneurial spirit of Americans. I was looking over quotes on bureaucracies, and one that stuck out right away was from President Donald Trump, who said, America is becoming so snowed under by bureaucratic rules and regulations that it's almost impossible to do anything anymore. So that's the subject on the table today with Erica Smith, who is a senior attorney for the Institute of Justice in Washington, D.C. But we are going to go with Erica after this break to North Dakota, and we're going to sue those bureaucrats who are putting an end to the freedom to buy and sell food from other people. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, and What's Eating What are the rules and regulations and how to get rid of them. Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back, and we are talking with Erica Smith, who is a senior attorney for the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C. What a wonderful job you must have. It would be so much fun to sue bureaucrats. What fun that must be. But I bet they put up a pretty good fight, do they, Erica?
Well, first I'll say it's very therapeutic to sue the government. I love it. I have the best job in the world. Sometimes they put up a fight, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes even when they try to put up a fight, they just don't do a very good job because they're the government. But usually we win, so that's a good thing.
Well, I'm happy to hear that you're winning in the fight against big government and big bureaucracy. Well, let's go to North Dakota. And the people of North Dakota decided that they wanted to be allowed the freedom to buy and sell food from each other. So they petitioned their legislators, and the legislators came through and passed a cottage food bill law. And it was, as you said, one of the best in the nation. What made it so, Erica?
It was one of the best in the nation because it allowed people to sell virtually any type of homemade food, anything from cookies and cupcakes to pizza and lasagna. So snacks, desserts, meals, chicken products, a whole bunch of things. The only thing you couldn't sell were foods made from certain meats like beef or seafood.
Mm-hmm. So free, you could do pretty much everything. So you could set yourself up in a little business in making pizzas or frozen pizzas or whatever and sell them to your neighbors. And you could develop quite a reputation around the neighborhood as the pizza person or something like that or whatever. What a service that would be if you come to think about it. You wouldn't have to go across town to get a pizza or order one in across the street and get one from your neighbor. But something happened to take away the freedom in that food cottage legislation, and it was the bureaucracy of the North Dakota Department of Health, correct?
Yes, that's right. The department really did not like the cottage food law. And in fact, they fought for 3 years, tooth and nail, to try to restrict the types of foods that could be sold under the act. They tried to get the legislature to change the law. Then they tried to pass agency rules. We threatened to sue them, so they withdrew those. Then they went back to the legislature. The legislature again turned them down. And finally, they went through with it and passed the agency rules. They passed rules that directly contradicted the very text of the law and said that the only foods that you could sell under this law were shelf-stable foods, a couple types of cooked vegetables, and actually, ironically, raw poultry. So it completely gutted the law and went against the legislature's intent.
Now, was this, you said they passed the rules. Did the rules pass through the legislature? Or
no,
did they just make up the rules?
They just made the rules up. They went through their own rule process, and they just enacted the rules on their own without approval from the legislature.
Okay, so you have the politicians making the rules, and the bureaucrats are saying, well, the heck with you. We're going to do what we want. Isn't that kind of like a coup?
Oh, for sure. And it's completely illegal, and that's why we sued them. Any sort of agency only has authority from the legislature. So they cannot just go against the legislature. They have to follow the law, just like all of us have to follow the law. But that's not what the Department of Health did here. The Department of Health decided that they are an authority of themselves and they were just going to do whatever they wanted.
Now, isn't it the case that bureaucracies often get away with that? Because the Institute for Justice isn't around all the time.
No.
So if somebody's not there looking and watching and seeing this activity, they get away with it.
It is true. There are so many different agencies in this country that they get away with it all the time. But we are not going to let them get away with it this time, especially not when it comes to food freedom, because food freedom is something we've been fighting for years, and we care very deeply about it.
It's one of the ultimate freedoms, if you think about it.
I totally agree. I mean, what's more intimate than the food that we put in our bodies?
Now, going back to the fight by the food bureaucracy against the food legislators, what were the bureaucrats objecting to in the notion of food freedom? Why did they stand up and say, you can't do this, we won't let you?
Well, in their view, certain types of homemade foods pose a safety hazard, and they thought they knew better than the legislature as to what foods people should be able to buy from each other. Did the department do this? And I was saying they were claiming it was a food safety issue.
Okay. Well, Erica, why is it that the bureaucrats of the food of the North Dakota Department of Food, whatever, stood up to the legislators in the way they did to say no? What gave them the right to say no?
Well, nothing gave them the right. The law is very clear that the agency cannot go against the legislature. They have to follow the law just like anybody else does.
And, of course, they use the excuse of food safety, which is one of the most common excuses made. But did not the people of North Dakota make a tacit agreement with the legislators that they would assume the burden of food safety in this cottage food law?
That's exactly right. The law says that if you're selling homemade food, you have to inform the consumer that the food is homemade and not inspected. And it at that point should be up to the seller and the consumer whether they want to do business with each other. But the Department of Health disagreed, and they thought that they should be the ones to decide what food people buy.
So in essence, then, the bureaucrats launched a coup against the legislators and the citizens of North Dakota both.
That's right. And I would like to add that Wyoming actually has the same law as North Dakota does. They passed their law in 2015, and North Dakota modeled their law after them. And there has not been a single instance of anyone being harmed by any of these homemade foods in either of these states. So this whole idea that you have to ban the sale of homemade foods because of food safety is just completely speculative, and there's no root in reality.
Well, we've done some radio shows with Bill Marler, who is an attorney who does a lot of food safety lawsuits from the big mass contaminations of industrial foods. You know, somebody messes up the spinach and it sickens people in 49 states or something like that. And he takes on those kinds of cases. And I once asked him whether he's ever run across a case of food contamination in farmers markets. And he said, no, haven't. And it just seems like if you're selling food to somebody, you know, you're looking them right into their eyes and saying, this is food that I grew and I took care of it. And it just seems like it's a pretty good transaction to me. But that being the case, the bureaucrats decided it wasn't. It decided that the legislators were wrong in passing the bill, and it was decided that the citizens of North Dakota were wrong in wanting the bill. So the bureaucrats, what did they do? They passed. They established their own rules and regulations that negated the bill.
That's exactly what they did, and that's why we sued them.
Well, what is their defense?
We don't know what their defense is yet, actually. They filed a motion to dismiss a couple of weeks ago. We're actually filing our response today. And they actually argue that they don't get into the merits of the lawsuit at all. They argue that the court should not even hear the case. Instead, all these cottage food producers who have now been put out of business should ask the department to reconsider their rules before they can bring this lawsuit in court, which is, it's insulting because hundreds of cottage food producers have fought with the department for 3 years, asking them, begging them not to pass these rules. And the department did it anyway. It would be futile and just a waste of time to go back now and ask them, oh, can you please change your mind? They're obviously not going to change their mind. The only way to get resolution of this case is to have a court decide it. That's what we're asking.
So what is the real reason the North Dakota Department of Health opposes food freedom?
Well, we are not sure exactly. In other situations where we've seen this happen, we have lawsuits in other states on similar issues. We do see that the department is acting at the behest of trade groups, lobbying groups, who are trying to protect themselves from competition. So For instance, that is the issue in our case in New Jersey. New Jersey is the only state that completely bans the sale of homemade food. You can't even sell a home cookie in New Jersey. They're the last state to do that. And the reason for that, which pretty much everybody agrees with at this point, is because of lobbying groups, that the grocers and the retailers don't want to have to compete. I don't know if that's what's happening in North Dakota. It's certainly possible.
Well, it would seem like North Dakota would have a huge infrastructure of people who buy and sell food with other people. And I don't know what the big lobbying group would be unless it was a grocer's organization or something like that, standing up against that. But if they have enough juice, they can do it, I guess. But that leads me to wonder, how exactly does a big business get bureaucracies to work for them? It's easy to see, for example, how you could get politicians to work for you. You could just, you could take a $10,000 gift and give it to a politician for his great-grandmother's high school prom or something like that, something ridiculous, and there you go. You got a vote. But how on earth does it work with bureaucracies? How do bureaucracies, which are ostensibly, to be kind of neutral parties, how does a big business get into bureaucracies and work with them?
That's a really good question. And I actually had a law student ask the same question a couple of days ago. I'm not certain what the answer is. I think it varies very much from agency to agency. I suspect it has to do with the fact that people who head agencies and run agencies are hired by politicians. They have to work with politicians. And all these relationships are really intertwined. So even if you're not accepting a campaign donation from a lobbying group, you can still be affected by them.
So that kind of brings up the notion of the swinging doors, where you're a politician one day and you're a lobbyist the next day and you're a bureaucrat the following day or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the people who are running things are the people who are running things. And if you happen to be in office one day and you're talking to people who are out of office a few days ago, so there's that relationship going. And I guess that would have a lot to do with it. But is it easy to bribe bureaucrats?
I don't think this is an issue of bribery. I have never heard of a bureaucrat being bribed in any of my cases. I think it's more subtle, the corruption. And it's more like, if you rub my back, I'll rub yours. So I don't think there's actual money exchanging hands. It's more subtle than that.
Okay. I know that there are cases, for example, where a meat inspector, might take a bribe or something to overlook something that should not be overlooked.
Sure.
But that probably goes on.
But I think when you're talking about, in a situation like this, when you're talking about agency rules, the people who are making the decisions are really much higher up on the food chain. And I think that bribery perhaps is less likely to happen in those situations than if you're just talking about like a low-level inspector. But I could be wrong about that.
Mm-hmm. So in suing a state like North Dakota, and it sounds like you sue a number of states who has set up these rules and regulations to restrict trade. What percentage of rules and regulations are designed to restrict trade, would you guess?
Oh, I would have no idea. I would say quite a lot. Usually anytime an agency is passing a rule, it's to limit freedom, not make more freedom. It's very rare that we see rules doing something good. It does happen, though.
It does. Well, give us a wild guess. Would you say it's...
I would not venture to guess. I have no idea.
How about I'll guess then for you? And
okay.
I'll say 75% of rules and regulations are designed to restrict trade. Would you say that's a wild and crazy guess?
I'd probably higher than that if I had to put money down on this.
Wow. So there it is, folks. Maybe 80-85% of the rules and regulations are designed to restrict trade. And today we're picking up the issue as well. How does one get those rules and regulations made for you so that you can restrict those who do not have the economies of scale that you do and do not have the competitive abilities that you do? How do you get them out of the marketplace so you can have a clear trail down the way to making lots of money? And that was this thought that struck me in the closing of all the moms and pops during the COVID crisis. When we come back, we're going to look at, see if there's a way that small businesses can compete with big businesses that have all the access to the rule makers. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Today. We're talking with Erica Smith, who is a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C. The Institute and Erica are taking on the state of North Dakota, the Department of Food and Health, and they want to make the Department of Food in North Dakota do what they were ordered to do by the legislature, which is to grant the people of North Dakota the right to buy and sell food from each other. You sell me a loaf of freshly baked bread, I'll sell you some freshly turned butter. And together we'll sit down and break bread together and have a nice neighborhood to live in. No, they say, you may not do things like that. You must buy food from the giant grocers and or somebody like that. You must not have the freedom to buy food from each other. And how are you going about suing them, Erica? What do you do when you sue a state like that?
Well, what you do is first you have to team up with people who are being affected by the law. And here there's hundreds of people who are selling homemade foods, many of them farmers, who were either put out of business or their livelihoods were severely restricted after the agency passed their illegal rules. So we paired up with five of them, and we filed all the paperwork in late March, and we notified the Department of Health that we were suing them.
Mm-hmm. So you sent them a certified letter and say, see you in court.
So when you file a lawsuit, you file it through something called a complaint, a legal complaint. And it can be anywhere from a couple of pages, even 30 pages. And it talks about really why you're suing them, what your legal claims are, and all the facts and allegations that back up your legal claim. So that's what we did here. Our legal claims here are that the rules are illegal because the legislature passed this law and the agency rules contradict this law, so that the rules have to be illegal. They can't undermine the law. And the second claim that we brought is that the rules violate equal protection because they arbitrarily allow some foods but not others. For instance, under the rules, you can sell cheesecake, but you can't sell cheese pizza. The other equal protection claim we brought is actually about a charitable exemption that the Department of Health has. The Department of Health allows you to sell these foods if you're doing so for charity or at a community event. In fact, one of the directors at the Department of Health testified to the legislature that it is perfectly legal to sell sloppy joes at school baseball games, but you can't sell the same exact food to support your family.
Well, that kind of negates their whole argument about food safety then, doesn't it? If you can sell it here but not there, then it's an arbitrary...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you put these complaints on the table, and then what does the Department of Health do?
Well, then the department was quiet for a while. We gave them an extension because we understood they had a lot on their plate because of the pandemic. But after a month or so, they filed a motion to dismiss. and the motion to dismiss didn't dispute our legal claims. What it said is that, hey, we don't think the court should decide these issues. We actually think we should decide these issues. You should come to us and bring your claims to us and have us resolve them first before it even gets to a court, which doesn't make any sense because, I mean, one, the department has already made its views very clear on these issues, and two, an agency doesn't have the power to decide its own authority. We are arguing that these rules are illegal because the agency doesn't have the power to contradict the legislature, and you know, the agency is certainly going to have its own views about its own power, just like government everywhere has its own views about its own power.
Isn't that the greatest fear that those of us out here in the world have of bureaucracies, is they have this unfettered power to do whatever they want, it seems.
That's why we have...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, that's why we have the court system. The court system exists to keep government bureaucrats in check and protect our rights and protect the Constitution. And that's why it's so important that the court hear this case and protect the farmers and small business people all across the state of North Dakota from this agency that's just out of control.
Now, you have an agency that's out of control, and it's been out of control, what, for 30 years, you said? That's kind of the trend.
This particular agency on this issue for 3 years, it has been out of control.
Okay. Is that a person, do you think, behind this? Is somebody in the bureaucracy who has decided that I'm going to take charge? This is my turf, and nobody's going to tell me how to run my turf. Or is it like a bunch of people who are not going to make any changes because we don't make changes? If you ask us to change something, we're not going to do it. Do you think it's one person or a bunch of people?
I think it's probably 2 to 3 people, and because they fought very, very hard to get these rules passed. It would have been impressive if the rules they were trying to pass were good rules, but they did not give up. They kept going to the legislature over and over again and saying, please restrict people's freedom. And the legislature did the right thing and said, no, we're not going to do that. And the department didn't give up, and they decided they would just take the law into their own hands and pass these rules. So it was definitely a concerted effort on behalf of a couple of high-ranking people at the department.
Okay, and so they've been there for a while, and they're the head cheeses, if you'll pardon the expression. And so they go about making these rules and regulations and making rules and regulations and making rules and regulations. And pretty soon, there's a lot of rules and regulations.
That's absolutely true. There are, I don't even think people understand how many tens of thousands, if not millions, of rules and regulations are out there.
So where do you begin peeling them back so that people can have a career and a job and make things and do things?
Well, we at the Institute for Justice are very careful to focus in on only 4 areas of law, and that's free speech, economic liberty, which is the right for people to earn honest living without unreasonable regulations, property rights, and school choice. And we think it's very important for us to stay confined to those areas because otherwise we'll get spread too thin and then we won't really stand for anything. So we stand for those 4 principles. And when we see that there is a rule or a regulation in one of those 4 areas that's brought to our attention, we go after it. And so far we have a pretty good track record.
Well, how do you go after it? Because the other side has money.
Well, fortunately, we are lucky enough to be supported by many, many very generous donors. We're a national nonprofit organization, and we're able to sue the government over and over and over again because of those donations. So we can fight the government. A lot of times we do a lot of better jobs than the government, and that's how we win against them. And we also, there's another thing we do. Not only do we sue the government, but we also use the media to share these stories and inform people exactly what's going on behind the scenes. And when you have the public behind you, it is very, very useful, because the public will get outraged as well. And, you know, judges read the newspapers too. They see what's happening. And that's, so we really just combine forces to allow justice to prevail.
It would seem like the only way to beat money is with votes. Enough votes.
Well, I mean, for us, we do some legislative work, but the primary thing that we do is lawsuits. So really what we want are the votes of the judges and the justices. And it's a beautiful political system we have in this country, because we have checks and balances. And sometimes the votes in the legislature are not a good thing. Sometimes what the majority wants is actually to take away freedoms. And that's why it is so important that we have the courts to be able to review the laws and regulations and be able to say whether or not they're fair and constitutional.
Which do you find yourself suing the most? Is it the legislators or is it the bureaucrats?
Well, you can't sue legislatures. Legislators are personally protected from lawsuits for the most part. So if we were to go up against the legislature, what we'd be doing is challenging a law. And usually we go after the law and then the government department that's actually in charge of enforcing the law. So let's say, for instance, a legislature passed a law restricting food freedom, but then they said, hey, it's up to the Department of Health or the Department of Agriculture to enforce this law. So we would then sue, we would go after the law and we'd sue the department, and sometimes we'd go after the state attorney general as well. But to answer your question, which I think was really your question, is whether we go after laws or regulations more.
Right, there you go.
I think we do go after laws more. We do go after a fair amount of regulations. Sometimes a lawsuit will challenge both. And, of course, we also go after city ordinances as well. Those are laws that are passed on a local level.
Well, you mentioned the fact that one of your four objectives is to secure the right for people to be able to earn a living. Food freedom and freedom to earn a living. Now, do you see a way in this avalanche of rules and regulations and laws that are all look like they are set up to protect and restrict trade, to get rid of little people? Do you see a way through all of this for little people? For the people who are buying and selling food for each other in North Dakota, how do we fight?
Oh, I think we fight together. We fight by one very effective way to bring about change is for members of the community to get together and to stand up and write editorial pieces, protest, talk to their legislators. Or they could pair up with us and bring a lawsuit. I feel very confident that, you know, the little guy can fight the man. We have been fighting the man for 30 years and winning. So I feel very optimistic. Every year we get more and more laws struck down and bring more and more freedom to people.
And did those small people of North Dakota band themselves together and seek out your help? Is that the way this process started, your lawsuit against the state?
That's exactly what happened. The people in North Dakota have been very well organized. They have been fighting very hard. It's been quite impressive. Many, many people testified at the legislature in support, both in support of the good law and against the proposed bad laws. And there were also dozens and dozens of people that testified against these rules. They are very well organized. They believe in freedom, and they are determined to win, and we're determined to help them do that.
Well, we'd certainly like to get our hands on some of their food, I'll tell you that. Because if they're that much full of fight, I bet their food is full of nutrition as well.
It definitely is.
So that must be fun to take on the federal government and help the little people fight their way through, because, you know, it just it looks like the rules and the regulations and the laws are all stacked against the little people in favor of the big people. And there must be a way around it. There must be a way to fight it. And now you're up against the state of North Dakota. You're suing them. You're going to force them to allow people to buy and sell food from each other. What are they going to do?
I think they're going to lose.
You think they're going to lose, but how long will they lose for? Will they lose forever?
That's a good question.
Will they come right back at you with more rules and regulations next week that you have to sue them for?
Yeah, that is a very good question. In our experience, after we win a lawsuit, it really makes the agency or whatever bureaucrat we're going up against, it really makes them feel quite defeated. And they really learn their place, and they are very careful not to go up against us again because they learn their lesson. There have been a couple instances where they did not learn their lesson, and we had to slap them back down again, and then they did learn their lesson. So I think if we win this lawsuit, I don't think the agency will come back and try to do something else illegal. I think what's more likely to happen is that the legislature will be emboldened and see how many people really do want this food freedom, and they'll expand what is already a very, very good law and make it even better.
Well, so amen to that. On behalf of everybody in the world, you want to thank Erica Smith and the folks at the Institute for Justice for fighting the good fight for people who want to have the freedom to buy and sell each other's food. Thank you, Erica. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.